So I was intrigued that this work has emerged out of a recognition that the level at which we were discussing climate and many of the other crises that are facing humanity and the biosphere, or the life world as a whole, that the level at which we were having that conversation was not the level at which that conversation needed to happen. I wonder if you want to say a few words about that movement in yourself and where you ended up.
Yes. Thanks, Elizabeth. Well, it's probably more complex than a single movement. That is to say, the Dark Mountain Project, which started with a manifesto that Paul Kingsnorth and I wrote, but came out in 2009, already reflected a sense that Paul and I had had at the point where we met and came into conversation and into collaboration of something lacking in our experiences of the environmental movement that we had been active within, both of us in those days living in the UK. And at that point in time, it felt as though there was, on the one hand, you would see prominent speakers about climate stand up and give the same kind of speech that you'd seen them give 5 years earlier. Mm. And it would still have the same rousing conclusion of, you know, this time we can do it. This time we'll organize and go to the COP meeting and make a big enough noise that they will listen to us. And then if you caught the same person quietly over a drink at the end of the night, they would admit to being pessimistic to the point of despair. And it felt like that gap between what people felt they needed to say publicly, the voices, the messages, the feelings that were acceptable within the space of the kind of activism we were involved in, and the things that people were feeling in their hearts, that distance between the two was becoming dangerous. And I've sometimes said it started to feel to us as though the environmental movement was in danger of becoming a church where the priests had lost their faith. Mm. But they didn't think that the ordinary people who came on a Sunday morning were ready to hear the bad news. Mm. So that was one thing that was kind of guiding us when we started Dark Mountain. And another was a sense that the depth of the trouble that we were in that was maybe being covered over by this need to deliver an optimistic message was also a qualitative depth that, the way I put it more recently when I was writing at Work in the Ruins is we often talk or hear people talking as if the trouble we're in is a consequence of a piece of bad luck with the atmospheric chemistry, that it turned out, you know, seven generations down the line, that the fossil fuels on which we were building modern industrial societies were having all of these knock-on effects on the atmosphere. And that's the nature of the trouble we're in. And it sort of seemed to me and Paul, right back when we started working together, that this wasn't a full account of the nature of this trouble. That in some sense, it was truer to say that we're in this trouble because of a way of approaching the world, a way of seeing and treating everything and everyone that would anyway have brought us to such a crisis, even if the atmospheric chemistry was different, or even if it turned out that the IPCC had done their sums wrong and the carbon emissions were harmless. So, you know, those things were already guiding my work from the era when we started Dark Mountain. But I found myself getting invited into a lot of conversations and collaborations with climate scientists and activists and other actors, where those conversations were often being brought together because of a sense of lack, not least on the part of the scientists, a sense that there's something missing. from what they were doing, that it wasn't having the effect that it ought to be having. And often the initial assumption seemed to be that, you know, that climate science had done the work of knowing this thing called climate change, but they needed our help to communicate that knowledge to everybody else. And I was often walking into those rooms with a kind of an artist hat on. For a few years, I was leader of artistic development at Riksteatern, Sweden's national theatre. So, part of what I came to those rooms to say was, I don't think it's quite like that. I don't think the art is a message delivery system for helping to communicate the things that you guys know over here to these other people over there who you want to get to listen to you. But maybe there's something else that we need to do together. And I stayed deeply involved in a lot of those conversations where climate was certainly the entry point and often the frame for the conversation for a long time. Partly because it seemed to me that for those who are most sheltered from other aspects of the trouble that the world is in, for the winners of modernity, if we talk in the language that you might hear Vanessa Machado de Oliveira speak in, climate change is often the place where the story breaks, where the shiny surface, the promises of the upward trajectory of progress cracks, and a sense of, oh, gosh, we might not be able to make this way of inhabiting the world sustainable. Like, this project that was meant to lead to the future might be coming to an end. And so in a lot of the spaces where I was working, it felt as though climate change was kind of the entry point to a larger conversation about the scale of the depth of the trouble. But the sort of moment of pause that led me to write this book was partly born out of a concern during the COVID time about the way in which the language of science, the language of following science, the language of believing in science, was ratcheting up to a new kind of intensity. And the reason why that was troubling me was because in all of this work that I'd been doing around climate, the move that I was making that seemed to be opening up good possibilities was to say, climate change asks us questions that climate science cannot answer, that actually we can't ask the scientists to do all of the work of knowing a thing like climate change, let alone telling us what we need to do, that there are other ways of knowing that need to be brought to the table, questions that can't even be asked clearly if we are assuming that all of the work of knowing and framing this can be done by the scientists. And what began to trouble me was that this intensification of the political invocation of science in recent years makes it harder to start within a space that is by its nature framed by science, because climate change is a scientific concept. It's the work of the natural sciences that brings us much of the news about climate change and gives us ways of talking about it. But it became less clear to me that it was going to be possible to start from there and move to the things that science can't tell us about or help us with. And therefore, I felt the need to take a step back and try and tell the story of this work that I'd been involved in and ask the questions of, how else might we need to be talking in order to be really reckoning with the nature and the depth of the trouble we're in? And what if we need to start from some other places than where the climate conversation is increasingly focused? So that's a long answer to your question, but maybe it gives some sense of both my journey and where the book, the moment in that journey that the book was born out of.
Yeah, thank you. That's very comprehensive and powerful. The question that arises for me is so out of that, do we need to, and how do we face the depth of the trouble? Is that the work that we need to do in the ruins?
Well, when you
or
put
is
it,
there, or is there something else?
It's certainly not all of the work, but when you put it like that, it does sound like an important piece of work. And I think, you know, it would be a mistake to get hung up on arriving at a singular description of the trouble that we're in, because we're going to be like the blind man and the elephant when we try and reckon with this. But I find it helpful to listen to voices that are alive to the extent to which the trouble we're in is not just about the external effects of human activity and modern society on this thing we call the environment. There's kind of, sometimes we get into this story where what we're dealing with is the misfortune that we've been building this wonderful kind of society, and we've been on this great journey where things have been getting better and better. And then, unfortunately, it turns out that this was having these knock-on effects, these external effects on the environment. And then that comes back to bite us. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that the people whose voices I find helpful in navigating this stuff tend to have in common is that they want to name the extent to which something is already going wrong within the human world, within culture, mm-hmm. within our ways of being human together, that would anyway represent deep trouble, even if the immediate symptoms of it in terms of environmental crisis were not as acute as they undoubtedly are.
The climate crisis is born out of a mind, isn't it? Meaning it's born out of a way of thinking, being, and understanding who we are as humans in relation to the natural world and each other.
I would agree with that. Yes. And one way that might clarify this is if I were to compare Kate Raworth's donut economics model, which you will probably have heard of, which is an attempt to sort of define a safe living space for humanity, building on the work that folks here in Sweden at the Stockholm Resilience Center have done on these kind of planetary boundaries of the kind of ecological limits. And what Kate does is to then attempt to put in a kind of social floor, so that instead of the limits just defining a circle that we need to stay inside of, what you get is something that looks more like a ring donut, where we need to stay above the floor, but below the outer limits. Now, the trouble with that is that, as my friend Vinay Gupta has been known to say, the thing about the donut is there is no donut. If you define honestly the outer limit and then the inner floor, you find that there's no donut in between them. That, what we have taken to be the goal for a livable human existence, according to the standards of modern international development thinking, is not actually compatible at a planetary scale with staying within the planetary boundaries. But what might unlock that and sort of turn it around a different way is the work of a young Brazilian scholar called Neto Leao, who I met through the friends of Ivan Illich, who I was traveling to spend time with when we met this summer in Frankfurt, Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And Neto has been revisiting the work that Illich was doing 50 years ago when he was writing Tools for Conviviality and talking about thresholds of counterproductivity. And so Neto describes similarly to Kate Raworth, two thresholds. But where Kate has the social pushing in one direction and the environmental pushing in the other direction, Neto says, no, it's not like that. He says, as we are expanding the extent of the intensity of the activity that goes on within our societies, within our ways of inhabiting the world, first we cross a threshold that is a kind of cultural boundary, a boundary beyond which the speed, the energy intensity, etc., of a way of being human together breaks something in the capacity to be, in my language, a living culture. And on the far side of that, once that damage has happened, then in order to fill the gap of the absence of a viable culture, we get caught in these addictive cycles of production and consumption, which is what then pushes us towards the encounter with planetary boundaries. So, in other words, rather than the human pushing in one direction and the planetary pushing back at us from the other direction, which I think is the sort of mainstream sustainability story, I think it's worth attending to these voices who are saying, well, no, actually, something went wrong at the level of human culture, at the level of our ways of being human in place, which, you know, opened a kind of bottomless pit, a black hole. And it's feeding that black hole that generates this spiraling thing that we now take for granted as the economy, and that is founded on extraction. And then we end up in this maddening project of trying to create a green version of an extractive economy.
Can you drill into, like, what is it that you would say went wrong in human culture then?
So,
there are many takes on this.
There are many takes on this. One way that we could talk about it would be to listen to Robin Wall Kimmerer, who many of you will have come across her work, not least through her book, Braiding Sweetgrass. And one of the things that she sets out in that book is a kind of a synthesis or a common pattern within First Nations culture in North America that she calls the honorable harvest, principle of attempting to live in the world in such a way as to be worthy of what you take. Mm-hmm. Your presence needs to be contributing enough, giving enough back to the land and the place and the living things with which your life is entangled to, if I say justify, it sounds too moralistic. It's more pragmatic than that. Simply to balance out what you have to take in order to stay alive. And when she tells that story in the book, she then also talks about telling it at some private college in America where most of the students are completely tuned out and unable to relate to this. But then afterwards, this one Turkish student comes up to her and says, you know, that thing that you were telling us, that's what I learned from my grandmother in the village in Turkey. So it's not even just that it's a thing that is common to indigenous cultures around the world. It's common to grounded, place-based cultures. Mm. And actually, if you look at the mythologies of human cultures, they're full of stories about moments where people lose sight of that and painfully get reacquainted with the consequences of not paying attention to that and recover a relationship to something like that.
Or you're talking about village-sized 150 or so humans or a certain number of families together that have a relationship with each other, or they know, everyone knows somewhat who the other people are that they're sharing this living space with.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to essentialize it too much to that kind of scale. I think scale is important in the sense that, you know, for most of human history until quite recently, pretty much everywhere, most of the needs of a community were being met from within the community.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but enough of them to create resilience. And that was also true at the household scale.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the needs were being met at the scale of the household, or maybe with its immediate households. And that provides resilience, even when you're also involved in long-distance markets.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading Wendell Berry's recent book, The Need to Be Whole, which, among other things, includes a kind of distillation of things that he's been writing about for, 60 years or more. But one of the things that he points out amongst both Black and white agrarian culture in the US is the role of household provisioning.
Mm-hmm.
In giving people strength, giving people, you know, what Gandhi would have called Swadeshi, the ability to stand on your own feet through the fact that a good part of your needs can be met very locally. So that's not about people being kind of confined in their life. We actually, when we start to inquire into this, we find that people have been traveling incredibly long distances for virtually the whole of human history.
Mm-hmm.
I just, even not going that far back into human history, but my friend Alan Garner, when he was researching his novel Thursbitch, towards the end of it, found in a barn on a hill farm in a remote part of the northwest of England, a Tibetan prayer wheel that was under 250 years of junk. So it had arrived in the Cheshire Hill country at around the time of the Lisbon earthquake. It's one material trace of just how far the interconnections of human culture, even within a village-oriented world, have been. But
yeah, I totally agree with you about that. The connection that I wanted to make is that within these contexts, selfish behavior was punished very harshly, generally. That the kind of breaking from one's responsibilities and care for others in one's immediate community, and also the obligation to hospitality, were if you ongoingly showed yourself as selfish and self-oriented and ambitious in certain kinds of ways, that was not a value held by the village as a whole. That's one of the traits of cultures at this level of scale that creates
I want to just complicate that a little bit, because I think that if we were to invite a few anthropologists into the conversation, they would probably want to tell us that you actually see quite a diversity of patterns. So it's not the case that harsh punishment is necessarily a characteristic of the way that this works. It's more a pragmatic thing. So firstly, it depends a lot on the kind of local land and the creatures and species that you're involved with, because depending on the landscape, you may well be in a kind of marginal landscape in which the landscape itself punishes you very harshly for not collaborating. But there's also just a simple principle, which is, you know, and I experienced this today living in a Swedish village of 1,800 people. When you are going to see the person you're dealing with in a given situation again, you're going to see them at the school gate, you're going to see them at church on Sunday, you're going to see them, that creates, without the need for any kind of explicit, actually punitive systems tend to be more characteristic of larger scale societies.
I'm not talking about a rule-based punitive, but it implies a kind of abstraction.
Yes.
That I'm not referring to. And this is like the dawn of everything. One of Graeber's points in Wengrow's points is is about this. It's not an abstracted belief system. It's one that is in some ways emergent from how do people successfully live together.
Right. Yes, and will tend to be culturally held. That is to say, will tend to be held through the medium of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And images. So yes, it's not abstract in the kind of forms of abstraction that we associate with kind of modern Western culture, but it's also not simply kind of passively emergent. It's culturally mediated. I'll give you a story that helps to illustrate or that relates to this. Alan Garner, who I was telling you about, and he's 90 now, so he's been around and seen a lot. And at some point, I would guess in the 1980s, he told me he met a storyteller from Uzbekistan. This storyteller had been picked out at the age of 8 alongside two other village boys to go and live with the old storyteller, be part of his household, travel with him, learn from him. At about the age of 18, the other two boys were sent back as young men to the ordinary path of village life, while this one stayed on as the storyteller's apprentice. And at about the age of 40, he was allowed to tell a story in front of an audience for the first time.
Mm.
The seriousness with which the work of culture has been taken in, as you say, cultures of this kind of scale, without reducing it in a utilitarian way. One of the reasons why cultures, which by our lights look, you know, desperately poor, have put levels of resources which our artists can only dream of having dedicated to the development of, you know, your life as a culture maker within your society into something like how one becomes a storyteller, is because one of the multiple functions that storytelling is playing is precisely to hold the things that you're drawing our attention to in terms of the stuff that we need to know and we need to be reminded of in order to avoid falling out of the patterns which make it possible for culture and community and belonging and inhabitation to be ongoing in the long term.
Thank you. So how do you come to, it seems that these kinds of lessons are very relevant to us in thinking about being at work in the ruins.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe I should say a word or two about this language of ruins, because people sometimes say to me, you know, well, hang on a minute, we're not in the ruins yet. And there are a few different ways to turn that around. One of them is just to point out that the achievements of, you know, the sort of project of Western modernity have been founded all along on ruins.
Mm.
The ruination of other cultures,
yeah.
Ruination of our own cultures, because similar processes took place, especially in rural settings in Europe and elsewhere, as took place in the patterns of colonization. Now, it's not to say that the intensity of the violence was equivalent, although in some cases it really was, the European setting. In other cases, no, there's something way beyond that was going on in the horrors that were being perpetrated in colonialism. But it's important to recognize the symmetry of the internal processes that mirrored the external processes in the making of the modern European nation states and their identities.
Interesting that what just occurred to me is then use, because in some ways it happened simultaneously, but also before. The kind of expansion and acquisition of colonialism. And I wonder about the trauma of that being perpetrated outside.
Yes. So you're right. It's sort of both and, because on the one hand, I mean, Ivan Illich tells the story of Nebrija going to the Spanish queen in the same year that Columbus is setting sail for what turns out to be the Americas. And Nebrija is coming with this project for the standardization of the Spanish language, the mm-hmm. creation of a grammar book for a vernacular language, which no one had ever thought of.
Right.
And his proposal to the queen basically says, you know, you need this so that you can bring the unruly minds of your people under your beneficent rule. So very much the same logic is playing out inwards in the creation of nation states and outwards. On the other hand, and this is very true in the case of the British Empire, you have internal processes of displacement, especially in Scotland and Ireland, where the descendants of people who had been forced from their own land because they'd been betrayed by their own hereditary chiefs, in the case of, you know, my ancestors in Scotland, people who had been part of the clan and who had become incorporated into the English elite, and who then were, you know, applying this new calculative economic rationality to go, well, it would be more profitable to have sheep on the land than to have my own people on the land. And those people who were displaced from the land show up a generation or two later in Canada, in parts of what's now the United States, in later in Australia, on the front line of, you know, perpetrating, you know, passing on the trauma, perpetrating on other people and their lands what had been done to the land which their own ancestors came from. So you're right, it's both something that happens in parallel and something that happens in series.
Mm-hmm. And we were going down that track towards the what does, why ruin?
Why ruins? Yes. So the one sense is to be reminded that we're always already surrounded by the ruins of, you know, of other people's worlds that were made on the path that was then presented as progress. Another part of it is to say, you know, we're well into the process of the breaking apart of the promises mm-hmm. of that trajectory of progress. Just in ordinary life experience, mm-hmm. you know, from about 2010 onwards across the Western countries, you find in surveys that large majorities of the population say the younger generation are going to have a harder time than their parents, rather than the younger generation are going to have a better life than their parents. Now, the set of different explanations for why that is leads in all kinds of directions and can be captured by very different political currents. But that baseline lived experience of large majorities of the populations of the Western countries that, you know, something has gone astray, that's more than just a cyclical thing, has been there. And that, you know, and we see that show up in all kinds of different ways within what's going on in our societies. And it's not just confined to a sort of declining powers of the global north or the West. I was listening yesterday to a Chinese participant in the current online series that we're hosting with our school, who was talking about young people in China turning aside from the expectations that have been put on them. And she quoted one young woman saying, you know, I feel like the whole of my society has sought to make me into a rocket and launch me here. But I get up here and it's dark and it's lonely, and all I want is to find a way back home.
Oh.
And, you know, the processes are extending beyond, you know, we sometimes understandably can tell a story about the sort of the exhausted countries of the post-industrial West and how the cultural and economic and social momentum and energy is very different if you look at East Asia, for example. But actually, you know, four of the five countries with the lowest birth rates in the world are East Asian countries that are meant to be like part of the sort of new wave of Emerging economies that are the new sort of dynamism in a shifting world system. So there is something broader going on than simply a local phenomenon in Europe or in the West. And so then the sort of story that I'm telling partly has to do with what happens if you stop trying to treat this as something that needs to be fixed. Like, we need to find the solution so that we can get back to the path we were on. Mm-hmm. Or, which is often what happens, if we can't find the solution, then it's all over really soon and humanity's going to be extinct somewhere in this century. And I it's always really striking to me how people can flip very hard from the one to the other position. Mm-hmm. I think it's because there's a space that's actually a lot harder to lean into and inhabit imaginatively, which is where the world as we know it is not going to be made sustainable. Lots of things are going to continue unraveling, and there is a world worth living for among the ruins of that. And so really that's why it's at work in the ruins, is because this book is sort of the beginning of me trying to narrate how do we catch sight of the possibility that there's work worth doing and that there's a world worth living for in amongst all of this, without us having to try and patch up a kind of unconvincing optimism that's based on sustaining the trajectories and promises of progress as it was offered to us within modern Western industrial society.
Mm. So how do we, so that that's, that's how do we find what's worth living for, or what world is worth creating together?
Yeah,
that is outside of the paradigm of the modern West's narrative of progress.
Yeah, that's it. And part of it is listening to voices from elsewhere who have been trying to tell us things that were harder to see from here about the assumptions on which the project of Western modernity has been founded. So I give a lot of space in the book, especially in the later part of the book, to the people I've learned from, who are often coming from different parts of the global South, and offering what Gustavo Esteva and Madhusuri Prakash called in a book they wrote in the 90s, grassroots postmodernism. Mm-hmm. So this is not the postmodernism of Paris seminar rooms in the 1970s, nor is it the kind of conservative reactionary anti-modernism of Europe earlier in the 20th century, but it is a critique of modernity coming from thinkers and activists embedded in movements in parts of the world that have been on the receiving end of projects of modernization, rather than being the kind of the heroes of the story, mm-hmm. the agent mm-hmm. of the story mm-hmm. of modernity.
Well, I think the question of agency is really essential here, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that is part of, that's a deep dive. Because agency is something that we moderns, we mm-hmm. Western people who have been educated in the West, see our personal agency as inseparable from who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. how is it, what source of motivation, mm-hmm. where is the source of motivation and motivation in the sense of movement or even inspiration, where what is a different source from which to align oneself?
Well, I'll give you one piece on this that might be some help, which is, I think we need to reclaim the possibility the agency doesn't look like we were taught to think it should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons why I think you see people flip from the kind of attempt at an optimism of fixing it and making it sustainable and continuing the trajectories to a black pessimism of it's all going to be over really soon is because we get this phenomenon that I think of as a loss of faith while still inhabiting the theology of
right.
the law.
Right.
So specifically in relation to agency, I think that we have at an institutional level, but also as individuals, to the extent that we've been socialized to positions within the kinds of institutions that have been seen as central and seen as locations of power within modernity, we have a model of agency that's essentially modeled on an idea of what it might be like to be a certain kind of monotheistic god. Mm-hmm. So the model of agency is step one, omniscience.
Mm-hmm.
Step two, omnipotence.
Mm-hmm.
So your first move is that you need to attempt to survey reality from above, from a god's eye view, and produce an objective mapping of all that we need to know in order to act. And then the step two is we need to act on the world from above and change things with that superior perspective. And that's still the logic that is the default logic of lots of our institutions. And then the risk is that if you lose faith in that, but you haven't questioned the assumption that that is what agency looks like, then you simply feel that
it's not worth any. It's all over.
Yeah, you fall into a kind of nihilism. And so recovering the idea that agency might not look like that. I mean, frankly, recovering the idea that even being God might not be anything like that. But you know, before we get down the sort of theological rabbit hole, just to say that a Taoist approach to agency and movement might give us something to kind of catch sight of the possibility that there are other ways of having a meaningful capacity to act.
Think about Wu Wei.
That was where I was going to go. And I remember Alistair McIntosh describing one of his teachers when they were working on the land reform movement in Scotland in the 90s. And Alistair was kind of worried that, you know, but we're not doing enough. We're not making enough headway. And this older activist he was working with said to him, look, Alistair, we could exhaust ourselves running around trying to change this by using our own energy and they wouldn't even notice us.
Mm-hmm.
Our only chance here is to slow down and pay more attention and look for the movements that are already taking place within the world and look for the moment to act when you can tilt something one way rather than the other way. And that, you know, that successfully led them firstly to the community buyout of the island of Egg from the feudal landlord, and then to a national land reform policy that's incredibly radical that gives communities all over the Highlands and Islands the right to a secret ballot and a community buyout into community land trust ownership. And now I think 3 or 4% of the entire surface area of Scotland is now owned by communities through land trusts in this model as a result of that work that they were doing in the 90s. That's the application in practice of a Wu Wei approach to agency.
And just to name that, Wu Wei is action out of non-action, or non-action action.
Yes, which, doing, not doing.
Which is doing and not doing, which is about a profound letting go. But in that letting go, I think, as you bring in really nicely, that there is a capacity to be with what is happening.
Yes.
I was going to say a capacity for observation, but it's not about an observation in a subject-object mode, which
right.
is that which is essentially that theocracy I'm the ultimate subject and the world is my object, but that it's a being part of in its aliveness and being within it so that one can influence, so that one can say, maybe my intuition says this is a path toward greater aliveness, toward greater coherence, towards something that responds to the needs of something of the larger whole that we're part of.
Yes. I mean, another image that might help would be to say it's a model of agency where instead of it being like being a composer writing a score that a whole orchestra is going to perform, or being the conductor directing and unifying, synchronizing the movements of the whole orchestra, this is a model of agency that's more like being one musician within a huge improvisation, listening attentively for the moment where you can bring your note, you can bring your gift into the thing that you're all making together without it needing to be being projected through a single controlling mechanism. And part of what I like about that is that there's a time and a place for orchestras and conductors. We don't have to moralize it into one of these is good and one of these is bad, but we can say that the mode of orchestration has had such a monopoly on our idea of agency that we've forgotten that there are other ways of coming together to make music. And it might be the other ways that are most helpful to the kind of times that we're in and headed further into.
Mm. But one can also imagine that the whole metaphor of the orchestra can transform when it moves out of this kind of listening quality. That instead, meaning that from a different starting point, even things that have been archetypes of a kind of godlike response and control of the world can be reinvigorated in a different way.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a bit like when an orchestra comes together and there's a conductor, everyone's agreed to act as if.
Mm-hmm.
Act as if this person has total command and control. And that's fine. That's cool. Beautiful things can happen from that. No one's going to mistake that except in the worst circumstances, maybe, I don't know. It's not going to be mistaken for a dictatorship. The problem is when, rather than that being a special way of coming together and doing certain things that works really well for something we all enjoy doing together, we get stuck in that. And this is sort of back to what David Graeber and David Wengro are saying in that initial argument of the dawn of everything, that the story we normally tell about human civilization is actually the story of the point where we got stuck from having had a fluidity of moving between different modes of social organization to one of those modes becoming no longer just something that we do at this time in the year or under these circumstances, but becoming just how it always is, because that's how it ought to be. And that's the danger, is when one mode of agency gets stuck like that.
Well, and you bring in a really interesting question of imagination right now. That imagining, being able to imagine different ways of being alive together and being in the world together, is a critical aspect of breaking free from or releasing the potential that is inherent in life and that is inherent in life as us also. But with these kind of thinking of ourselves as these modular or these univocal, unimental creatures who are separate from anything that is non-material, so supposedly non-material, and each other, nature, etc., that to liberate ourselves from that is in a way that is an expression of our being. our presence is part of the work, and that is a work that is deeply embodied and also out of the subtle connections that exist between us and with a more than human world that we often just don't pay attention to.
Yes. Since you mentioned the word imagination, something I feel is worth saying is I think the same pattern that we were just talking about with agency, I think actually gets transferred into the way that imagination is mobilized.
Mm.
I've been in too many rooms where a group of people who see themselves as the good guys, the good people, are brought together to spend a day or a weekend trying to, you know, imagine a sustainable world in 2050 and then backcast from it for how we're going to get there. And, you know, working with Vanessa in the years before she wrote Hospicing Modernity, I remember her mentioning at various points she used to talk about presently unimaginable futures.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to grasp what she was gesturing towards with that.
Mm.
At a certain point, what came to me was, okay, the future's worth working for today are presently unimaginable because for us to be capable of imagining them, we would have to become other than who we are,
mm.
who we think ourselves to be. So the processes that might be worth experiencing in those rooms are not us mobilizing imagination as a form of willpower, but they are more processes involving a vulnerability of coming to see things that we hadn't noticed about ourselves that might be both uncomfortable, but also capable of taking us on a journey to becoming other than who we thought we were. And having been listening to the Wendell Berry book that I was telling you about before, brought me back to something that the storyteller Martin Shaw says. He says, you should never tell a story until you can inhabit each of the characters within it.
Mm.
The character within the story who you can only see from outside as a stereotype or as evil or as a bad guy, whatever, you're not ready to tell that story yet. And Wendell Berry is describing the role of imagination in, he's discussing the work of various Black American writers, and he has a in-depth discussion of this novel by a friend of his, where he says, and the most moving moment comes really near the end, where there is this character, is this white racist guy who's basically shown up expecting that this is, he's going to lead a lynching, and finds himself instead like surrounded by these five old Black men with shotguns. Mm. But he says, you know, there's this moment where this character says to his friend, you know, if I don't make it through this, look after Verma and the kids for me. And he's like, the generosity of imagination, of that moment of humanizing a character who, for so many historical reasons, it would be so easy for the author to cast simply as a cardboard cutout of evil. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the role of imagination in the political today, I really want to encourage that kind of application of the imagination, because I don't think that's often what people are trying to mobilize when they talk about imagination in some of the settings that I've been in.
I think that's wonderful. I think because what you're pointing to is, I mean, you mentioned generosity, but can we imagine being profoundly generous with those who we disagree with?
Right.
Can we imagine, it's a different movement. It's not a, I'm going to think my way into a future where everything's sustainable and, you know, the waters are instantly regenerated and everybody has lots of material goods, you know, whatever it is. But the potential for a new world is in these things that are not allowed by virtue of our current identity. Mm. And yet it's a calling from a deeper place into relationship.
Right.
Into the recognition of relatedness.
Yeah.